court will proceed to the third case of the day, Carrion versus the Illinois Department of Human Services. Mr. Andrews.
May it please the court. This is a case involving a grant of summary judgment where all of the rules specify that the facts are to be construed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which were my clients, and all reasonable inferences are to be drawn in their favor. The district court did a painstaking analysis of the separate claims of each individual plaintiff. What they failed to do was to take into account that this was a joint complaint and that the complainant's claims intertwined with one another. For example, one of the points made by Ms. Carrion was that she was being penalized for failing to cooperate and giving negative reports against Mr. Mungat. Mr. Mungat had been engaged in EEO activity in the past and union activity in the past, and yet in the analysis of Ms. Carrion's case as a separate entity, short shrift was given to the fact that there was a connection between that case and Mr. Mungat's. In addition, with regard to Mr. Diab's case, Ms. Hayes was asked to essentially create statistical information that would defeat his EEO case that he had filed. And also, Ms. Hayes had been allowed to have a flexible schedule, even though she was a registered nurse, while Mr. Diab had not been. And when she wouldn't cooperate, then she was written up for and not allowed the flexible schedule that she had been allowed in the past. With regard to Ms. Lovelace was asked to give false reports against Ronald Simmons, who was a known union representative and advocate of employee rights. When she refused to do so, she was cited for a failure to cooperate, and then she was placed in administrative capacity away from her duties as a nurse. So the one major flaw in the painstaking analysis by Judge Hart was the fact that it parsed out the different claims as though they were just separate claims and didn't take into account that there was a joint complaint against the facility and facility management and the hierarchy all the way up to the director of the Department of Human Services. For that reason, the judge made points that this particular individual did not show that this particular management official was aware of their activity. But if you take into consideration that the activities were known within the management structure, and they were known by the intertwining of the different complaints, then taking those into consideration, management officials would be responsible, would be aware of the lack of cooperation, which is what they seem to stress, and circumstantial evidence would allow a fact finder to determine that, in fact, it was these failures to cooperate on the part of all of the different plaintiffs and the failure to cooperate against one another that resulted in the adverse actions that were taken against them. The district court did appropriately indicate and rejected the argument of the defendants that in a First Amendment claim that it had to be adverse employment action, and they just pointed out that there could be adverse action in the First Amendment context that didn't arise to a EEO-type adverse action claim. And that therefore, for example, in the case of Ms. Carrion, where she was threatened with having to go back to units with violent patients, where she had actually been attacked by a violent patient, that this was in fact adverse action that could shield or have a detrimental effect on her ability to exercise her First Amendment rights. And the other thing that the district court didn't take into consideration is that all of these individuals were aware of what was going on with the other individuals. And they were aware of the efforts on the part of management to chill their rights to voice their opinions on public concerns and to, quote, not cooperate against their fellow co-workers.
Ms. Carrion, she was the junior person right when the transfer occurred, and so isn't there a rule that says that, you know, the junior person has to be transferred if there are no volunteers?
What it was that the least senior person was supposed to be transferred if there's no volunteers. Her argument was she was not the least senior person because the quote-unquote most senior person had left their position. And because normally when a person is in a situation where she's in, where they've actually been attacked, physically attacked, the facility does take it into consideration in making transfers. They don't simply transfer someone where they know that that type of situation has occurred. So while the argument can be made, and certainly it's a legitimate argument on the part of the management to say, we only did it for this reason, that again is a fact question. You know, a jury is entitled to accept that if they want to, a jury is entitled to reject that if they want to, based upon this whole pattern that was exhibited by management to punish anyone who they felt, quote, did not cooperate with them. So if this were a question of a determination by a fact finder that they felt that there were legitimate reasons for them doing what they did, frankly, wouldn't be here and certainly wouldn't be making these arguments. But this was a summary judgment proceeding. And so the question here is whether or not a material fact existed that would allow this to go to a jury to have them determine it. The jury doesn't have to accept the statements by management officials that they knew nothing about what was going on in light of the statements by the various plaintiffs that they knew exactly what was going on. And in fact, in certain cases, it would be impossible to affect the actions that they took without management officials knowing what's going on. For example, in the case of Ron Simmons, when they alleged that he abused a patient and they wanted him to speak to state police, and when Mr. Simmons indicated he wanted to have his lawyer present, they framed that as a lack of cooperation. And when they went to Ms. Lovelace, who was his supervisor, and asked her if he had abused the patient, and she said no, then she was punished by being taken out of her position and put in an administrative position where she received less benefits. So based upon all these things, a jury could decide, well, wait a minute, you know, we see management, whenever somebody doesn't do it the way they want it done, taking adverse actions against these persons. So we're entitled to look at their denials and say, well, that doesn't fly. The other thing is, we brought as defendants the director of the agency, the director of the facility, the head of personnel in the facility, and any personnel decisions that would have to be made, any points that would be made, would have to be known to those officials. A jury could say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense to say you didn't know. For example, there was an election being held to determine a change in the union. How could you say you don't know that? How could the director of the agency, the director of the facility, and all these people not know that these types of things were going on? How could they not know that a complaint of discrimination had been filed in federal court by Mr. Diab and a complaint of discrimination had been filed in federal court by Mr. Mungai? How could they not know these things? So a jury is entitled to reject those assertions on the part of management staff, particularly where management protocol would obviously call for them to be aware of what's going on before they issued orders, and where in some cases the director of the facility delegated authority to the director, to subordinates, to do these various things. So I think, again, the problem with the analysis by Judge Hart is these were individual cases brought separately, and he wanted to make that type of analysis without taking into consideration that these are joint complaints against the same individuals, then his points may be well taken. But when you take into consideration that this was, in fact, a joint complaint, and it was by all of the management officials who would be in a position to know things like who's bringing an EEO complaint, who's filing to have a union election certification, who is being disciplined for a, quote, failure to cooperate with management officials, it just, at minimum, allows a material issue of fact to be presented to a jury so that they could make determinations as to whether or not the motivation by management was some, quote, legitimate reason, or was based upon their desire to have and to force, quote, cooperation on the part of the staff. I reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Right, thank you, Sandy. Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Schmidt. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Illinois, and I represent the defendants appellees, the Department of Human Services, et al. I really didn't see much, if any, of what Mr. Andrew just argued in his brief, and I'll issue a brief response to it. Basically, Judge Hart thought a carefully reasoned 52-page decision was grounded in fact. I believe much of what Mr. Andrew just said is simply grounded in speculation, and you need more than speculation to withstand summary judgment. Some of what he said was wrong, and there is one thing I would like to correct immediately. He said that Ruth Lovelace was being intimidated into trying to testify against Ron Simmons. The record does not bear that out. She was at the scene of Mr. Simmons' alleged abuse, so she was questioned about that, but there's no evidence that they were, the defendants were trying to intimidate her into testifying against her.
Continue your thought for a moment.
She was moved off patient care duties while the matter was being investigated, but the record is also clear that is entirely consistent with hospital policy. If somebody like Ms. Lovelace is alleged to have seen patient abuse and not reported it, that person will be taken off patient care duties while the matter is investigated, and so will the alleged abuser. In Mr. Simmons' deposition, he explicitly acknowledged that policy, and he said, I had no problem with the fact I was taken off patient care duties.
Mr. Schmidt, I thought Mr. Andrews' main point was that given the procedural posture of this case on summary judgment, we should draw reasonable inferences. He had a right to present to the jury reasonable inferences from the facts. And what do you say to that?
That's absolutely true. My response would be that even if you, that those inferences still have to be based on some facts in the record, and that in this case, that is simply not the case. Mr. Andrew was talking to some extent that that management must have been aware that lawsuits were filed. But one problem with that statement is even if management was aware that those lawsuits in the context of this case did not constitute protected speech. They were not on matters of public concern. They were about matters of private concern. That included Mr. Diaz's lawsuit. Basically, the case law in this area establishes that the plaintiffs have to present facts on several, showing several different things to withstand summary judgment. The first thing would be that the speech is on a matter of public concern. I think in Mr. Andrews' brief, he was trying to argue that the plaintiffs spoke out. Bad things happened to them. Therefore, there are questions of material fact. Not so. First, he has to show that the speech is on matters of public concern, and in several instances, the district court found that plaintiffs had not engaged in any speech on matters of public concern. Secondly, there has to be some showing of knowledge of protected activity on the part of the defendant, and in a couple of cases, the district court held that that was not satisfied. There also has to be a showing that even if there was protected speech, that it actually motivated the adverse action. And in several cases, the district court held that that was not satisfied. And in one instance, the district court held that there was no evidence that any of the defendants were involved in the alleged adverse acts, and that related to Mr. Mungay. I can go through each of the individual plaintiffs. With respect to Ms. Carrion, the district court found that the only instance of protected activity was her union advocacy for the Teamsters Union at a different hospital, Chicago Reed, but the district court also found that there was no evidence that the defendants were aware of this. And I think it's understandable that officials who worked at the Madden Center might not have been aware of what was going on at Chicago Reed. The director of DHS was also a defendant here, but I believe that director was not even the director of DHS at the time of the alleged union advocacy. So there was no evidence that any of the defendants were aware of her protected speech. All that they really cited as evidence was the fact that apparently Ms. Carrion testified that she was with a union official once, and the official was escorted off the premises. She said by administration, but there were no specifics about who did it or what. And those specifics could have been uncovered in discovery, but that's all the information we have. And that's speculation. That's not enough to withstand summary judgment. With respect to Mr. Diab, the district court found that he had not shown that he engaged in protected speech. Nor was there a showing, even if he had engaged in protected speech, that the defendants were motivated by that in firing him. Basically, Mr. Diab had a very poor record with regard to tardiness. He was suspended for it twice in 1999, and finally he was suspended a third time for being late nine times in a period of about 12 days in September and early October of 1999. That suspension was pending discharge, and he was discharged. He does not dispute that he had a very poor record with regard to tardiness. Ms. Hayes also had a poor record with regard to tardiness. It was not as bad as Mr. Diab, but there is no indication that anything but the tardiness would have motivated her discharge. As to Ms. Lovelace, again, I'll reiterate that the fact that she was taken off patient care duties and reassigned to clerical duties was entirely in accordance with hospital policy. Even if the defendant had been out to retaliate against her, and there's no evidence of that, that transfer to non-patient care duties would have happened anyway. It was the proper thing to do under hospital procedure. And also, with regard to Ms. Lovelace, there's no evidence of any protected speech activity. The thing that she claims caused retaliation was the fact that she said Mr. Simmons did not abuse the patient. That statement was made in the context of an in-house investigation, which is something that was addressing a personnel matter. It was not addressing some matter of public concern. Mr. Simmons, the district court concluded that there was protected speech in his case, and I think that's clearly correct. He had been a union steward. There was some advocacy on behalf of the union, and he was the one, of course, but getting back to his protected activity, the record's clear. Only one of the defendants, Ms. Varso, the personnel manager, had any awareness of that protected activity. Mr. Simmons is the one alleged to have been engaged in abusing a patient, and there was an investigation of that. Again, he's not complaining about the fact that he was taken off patient care duties. He's very clear about that in his deposition. he was upset about, he was complaining about the 3-day suspension that he received for failure to cooperate with the investigation. He, the record on this has to be construed in a light most favorable to him, and he said that he wanted to bring an attorney when he was requested to come in for an interview, and that that request was refused. And that's, and he did later interview with his attorney present. But, and, but, you know, for purposes of summary judgment, that has to be taken as true. That may seem to have been a harsh result that Mr. Simmons was suspended for that, but our but he did have remedies in his collective bargaining agreement for that. He could have grieved the discipline, and apparently what happened, according to his deposition, was that he asked a union official to grieve it and to process the grievance, and the union official didn't do that. But our position is that that does not rise to the level of a constitutional claim. Mr. Simmons was not, did not wish to have an attorney present to vindicate a matter of public concern. He wanted the attorney to protect his own rights, so that would not bring, that would not result in a valid First Amendment claim existing. And I think in our brief we've covered why the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights would not be triggered in this situation.
We need not even reach it. It wasn't raised, was it?
I don't think so, no, Your Honor. I think the district, I think Judge Hart was being extra careful. And in their appellate briefs here, Mr. Andre hasn't raised the Fifth and Sixth Amendment claims. So, no, I don't, I agree, Your Honor. You don't, I don't think you do need to reach it. As to Mr. Mungay, the primary problem the district court found was that there was no evidence that the defendants took part in the alleged retaliatory act. The main alleged retaliatory act was a failure to properly transfer him after he was threatened by a patient, and then he was transferred eventually, but he claimed he was transferred to a more dangerous pavilion. But the record, the Rule 56.1 statement reflects that none of these defendants really had anything to do with transfers of nurses from one pavilion to another. And finally, the final plaintiff is Mr. Taylor, who is the only person here who's not a nurse. He was a housekeeper. He claimed that he was retaliated against for asking for union representation at a disciplinary hearing, but that, again, would not be a matter of public concern. That would be, he asked, he wanted union representation to vindicate his own personal rights, so he really didn't engage in protective activity. And in addition, the record showed that he too had a very poor record with tardiness. He was late to work some 26 times in a 6-month period. Doesn't dispute that, and that's what ended up it causing his termination. The plaintiff's brief says that he was promised pension benefits, but then did not get them. I think we clear that up in our brief. What happened is Mr. Formigoni promised, basically in Illinois, you vest in a pension if you've worked for 8 years, but your first 6 months don't count while you're on probation. Mr. Taylor was very close to 8 years of work, and Mr. Formigoni apparently forgot that the first 6 months don't count. He offered to let Mr. Taylor work a few extra days to reach 8 years, but then the State Department of Central Management Services informed Mr. Taylor that he still hadn't vested in a pension yet. They did give him an opportunity to buy back or buy the extra 6 months of time by making contributions, the pension contributions that he would have made during the first 6 months, but he did not choose to do that.
In your argument, just as in Judge Hart's opinion, you went one by one with respect to the plaintiffs. Can you discuss Mr. Andre's point that he began with, that there's some overlap between various plaintiffs and how we should treat that.
Well,
that wasn't taken into account by Judge Hart.
I'm not sure that's correct, Your Honor. I think Judge Hart did take that into account. And I think the main situation where that existed would be the situation involving Ruth Lovelace, the nurse, and Ron Simmons, they weren't involved in the same incident, but Ms. Lovelace allegedly viewed the incident. And I think if you look at Judge Hart's opinion, he does acknowledge that, but there simply was no evidence, as I pointed out, that Ms. Lovelace was being retaliated against. She was simply asked, "What did you see?" And she was transferred in accordance with hospital policy. So I see the red lights on, and in closing, I just ask that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you.
Mr. Andrew?
Mr. Schmidt makes the point that many of the matters involved complaints that had to do with individual concerns of the various plaintiffs. That's true of a matter of public concern or not. When a discrimination case is filed alleging that discrimination occurred based on race, it has to be based on an individual claim. When a First Amendment claim is made and alleges that a retaliation took place because of the exercise of rights that the person had to express themselves, an individual claim has to be tied to it. But that doesn't make it not a matter of public concern. For example, with regard to Ms. Lovelace, Ms. Lovelace simply told the truth. There was no abuse that took place. And even though Judge Hart acknowledged that for purposes of summary judgment we have to accept that there was no abuse that took place, nonetheless, he still overlooked the fact that my client, Ms. Lovelace, was penalized as though an abuse had taken place, even though for summary judgment purposes we have to assume, and even he conceded that point, that we have to assume there was no abuse. And in fact, the investigation determined there was no abuse on his part. And that the only reason that he was penalized was because he asked for a lawyer before he would go forward with interviews with the state police. And in fact, those interviews were conducted, and he was still penalized because they alleged that he still wasn't cooperating. The problem with what counsel is doing is the same problem with what Judge Hart was doing, which is, again, trying to single out these acts by an entire administration at one facility. Because Judge Hart did separate this case from a number of other cases where there are different facilities, and those matters went on their own. Some of those were settled, some of those are still pending. But the point was, this was one institution that was taking place. All these things were taking place at the same time, and they were taking place by the same officials.
Over what period of time, Mr. Andrew, did all these things take place?
Basically between the year 2000 and the year 2002, I believe.
And during that time, will discovery tell us how many other disciplinary actions, or what percentage these are of all the total disciplinary actions that took place during that time?
No, we don't have that information.
So why should we not view this as that you've just cobbled together seven perhaps legitimate grievances as against I don't know what backdrop, and said, well, because there are seven individual grievances during a two-year period, this must rise collectively to the level of a First Amendment matter?
Well, because even Judge Hart conceded in his opinion that although my client didn't have access to personnel records, they were on the facility and they could see who, for example, were absent for long periods of time and who, therefore, was likely being suspended and who was not. So they would be able to observe the treatment of their coworkers who were in the same situation.
How do we contrast this? I appreciate the theory you're trying to advance. How do we contrast this against the total workforce? Do we know what the total workforce, will the record tell us that? I mean, what your clients represent, what fraction during this period of time had difficulties with the administration? Do we know that?
No.
Wouldn't it be helped by that if you were to advance that these were targeted individuals?
It would be helped by that if I were arguing some type of disparate impact type of argument, but that's not what I'm arguing here. I'm saying, and I think everybody concedes, that these are disparate treatment cases, not disparate impact cases. So we're not trying to say that statistically the statistics show that there was some wrongs done to my client on the basis of a statistical analysis. That's not the point. The point that we're making is, to give a good example, Ms. Loveless was allowed a flexible schedule at one point until she failed to cooperate. She failed, for example, to replace Ruth Loveless. She wouldn't do that. She refused to give negative reports on some of her coworkers. Then, suddenly, on what they call a change of policy, this allowance for flexible time was taken away. And my client, Mr. Diab, who had complained about discrimination, was never allowed at any time. And even Judge Hart concedes that there were other health care officials who had been allowed flexible time when Mr. Diab did not. So, no, we don't have a raw statistical analysis, but we do have comparators that are in the record. I would ask that the decision of the district court be reversed and that we permit it to go to trial.
Thank you, Mr. Andrew. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. The case is